I just love to compete. There's nothing like it to put yourself out there with a group of guys and try and have success. And I guess I got, to be honest, probably addicted to winning, loved the feeling of success, and would work extremely hard to make sure that I did my part in my job, and people treated me very well as a young kid. So I always thought that's another reason why you should treat your teammates well. Like, you want them to be good, you want them to help you.
Welcome back, or welcome to Grateful and Full of Greatness. I'm your host, Mark Lucini. On this podcast, I sit down with guests who, in my opinion, live their lives with the pursuit of greatness in mind. This platform allows me to discuss and explain strategies that go into reaching peak performance. This is episode 57. My guest is Gary Gate, current head coach of Syracuse University men's lacrosse. He was a four-time All-American at Syracuse as a player and won three NCAA championships, awarded numerous individual and team awards along the way. As an assistant women's lacrosse coach at the University of Maryland, he won another seven more national championships. He played professionally and internationally for roughly 20 years, winning multiple pro titles and gold medals in both indoor and field lacrosse. One of the greatest players, coaches, ambassadors in the sport, Gary is known for his sportsmanship, knowledge, and leadership at every level. He's on an extremely short list of all-time athletes and coaches, Hall of Fame through and through. So without further ado, Gary, thank you so much for carving out the time to come on here.
That's quite an intro, thank you.
you're welcome, and it's well-deserved. I mean, and congrats on the season so far. I know we're speaking in early March here, and you guys are within the top 10. I guess when I just want to start off with current events and what's leading to your success so far as a team.
Sure. Love to chat about it.
So tell me, you have a great group of men. I know you have a deep roster, but what would you point to as the factors that are making you guys successful so far?
Well, it kind of started, 2 years ago when I took over the men's program after coaching the Syracuse women's team for 14 years. The opportunity came up to coach the men's right after COVID. And, it was an incredible opportunity and to coach a team that I never thought in my wildest dream that, certainly as a player at Syracuse University, that I'd ever be the coach. And I still got to pinch myself every once in a while to say, I've talked to my old coach, Roy Simmons Jr., and kind of laughed. And, I'm like, I never thought coach, when I was in college, I didn't think coaching was ever a job or there would be an opportunity to do that. And to be able to come back to Syracuse was amazing. And then to have a chance to become the men's coach was amazing. And with that came the responsibility of trying to bring the program back to championship standard. And that's really been the process the last 2 years, is changing the culture and adapting to the times in recruiting, in behaviors on and off the field. And there was some work to be done, and it's been fun. It's been 2 years. We started out my first year 4-10. Not great. Had lots of issues trying to get buy-in to the things that we wanted to do and how we wanted to be as a championship caliber team. And then last year, the second year, recruited some transfers. Number one ranked recruiting class came in, and we started working with them along with a few transfers to change the culture and change the way that we were doing things at Syracuse, and they were on board. This year, we were by far the youngest team in the, in the top 25 in college lacrosse. Last year, we were playing more freshmen than anybody, and it was really our chance to try and give these young guys an opportunity to grow quickly. So that's what we did last year. We ended up 8-7, got some great experience, and then because of the turnaround from a 4-10 to a 8-7, all of a sudden we were able to attract top transfer portal kids. And that's something we couldn't do the year before. After a 4-10 season, people weren't eager to come play for Syracuse because they didn't think they were going to get a shot to compete in the tournament and that sort of thing. So it made it really tough. And we finished, as I always say, we finished second on a lot of transfer kids, that year. And this year, we were able to finish first on some of the best recruits, transfer recruits in the country. And the media out there is kind of dubbed that we won the transfer portal. And what I love about the kids that we got is they're all former captains from their previous teams. They're all mature. They've all, graduated from their respective schools in undergrad, and they want to come and they want to compete for a national championship. So it's really made a difference this year. And they, as captains, they're about the right things. Mix them with our young sophomores and the other kids on the team that are, want to win or on board. And all of a sudden we're able to compete with the best of the best. And that's kind of where we're at now. And last week was the first time that we were able to get over the hump and find a way to win. And that was something that we've been working on for quite a while, is how do we finish games? How do we win overtime games? How do we win one goal games? And we continue to work on that now. And hopefully we'll be good at it one day. It'll be much more consistent than we have been this year.
I mean, right before we started recording, and even last podcast when I was recording with Brody Merrill, he was talking about how you've always believed every single game as a player and a coach. You re-emphasized that probably about 15 minutes ago. You talk about finishing. Something that I think is important when it comes to that belief system is generating the evidence. So last week you guys generated the evidence, and you can continue to generate that evidence. You talked about championship caliber and championship standard. I love that, and I just want to double click on it because I want to know what it means to you. And I think it'll go into kind of like a nature nurture. Do you have to have the talent versus, the right culture? But what do you mean when you say that championship caliber and championship standard?
I just, been a part of a lot of championship teams, and they have behaviors and expectations, and they hold each other accountable. And, as coaches, we've set, the marks and what the expectations are for practice every day, behavior off the field, taking care of yourself, getting sleep, putting yourself in the best position to have success every day. And that includes taking care of the classroom, doing whatever you need to do so that you can focus on lacrosse and put your best effort in.
That holistic aspect is massive, and I think that expectations that you have of the team, it's obvious, Gary, that you've always had them. When did those expectations start for you? Where'd you get that underlying belief that you'll be in it no matter what game you're playing in? Where does that come from?
Oh my God, that comes from when I was a kid. I started playing lacrosse young, age 4. And it was something, I was born on a street in Victoria, British Columbia. My twin brother and I were born. And then 3 weeks later, another set of t identical twins were born 3 houses down the street. And we terrorized the neighborhood. Two sets of identical twins. Nobody could tell us apart, and we grew up together, and we grew up competing with each other, and it was awesome. from, simple games like tag, we always had four equally athletic kids that could play games, play soccer, football, you name it, we were doing it. And I would just did it for fun then. And I realized that I was kind of an average lacrosse player, I would say four until about 11. And realistically, I didn't think about the sports other than just playing them for fun. And really just went to practice, did what the coach said, and never really thought anything more of it, And our teams, just because of the kids we had and how competitive we are, we had success. They actually have, much like hockey, they have like novice championships, peewee championships, all that young age. And we started getting to the provincial championships at, 9, 10 years old. And then, we were coached by the others, my dad and the other set of twins' dad, who really didn't grow up playing sports. They were coaching us. And they really just looked at each other, my dad and my friend's dad, and they said, "You know what? We need to find somebody that knows what they're doing here."
Yeah.
So they
Who did
went
it, who did it become?
out and they talked in. It became this guy, Ron McNeil, and Ron was a superstar Canadian box and field player, and Hall of Famer, and he had moved out to Victoria when the 74-5 professional box league folded, and the Ontario Lacrosse Association said anybody that played in the pro league can't come back to Ontario. So they all, this whole group of Ontario lacrosse players, when the league folded, came out west. And I was the beneficiary of that, along with many other teams in British Columbia, because these guys all moved from, the East Coast to the West Coast, and they played. And my dad was lucky enough to convince this guy to coach, at the time, a bunch of 11-year-olds, because we were pretty good. And he was a, this is 1979. 78, 79. And he took over, and he really started, he treated us differently, as young kids. And it's he treated us as athletes, and he put expectations on us. And if you want to be a part of this team and have success, you have to practice, and you have to understand what we're trying to do. We have to be organized, disciplined. You have to train outside of lacrosse. So we were doing things that was very unique at the time. But even more unique is that, 12-year-olds were doing meditation and visualization as a team. 1979. We were doing interval training, modern training methods for conditioning at that age. It was pretty funny when I look back, like what parents would let their 12 tell, but we just kept winning. So they were like,
Right.
okay,
Yeah.
we were very organized, very disciplined, and we had success. And it was the year that, changed me for lacrosse. And I went out. And he not only did the training aspects, the mental preparation, but he really, for me, was a great coach, because he taught me how to learn the game. And the one thing he always did was he always said, "You got to know why you're doing a drill, and you want to know what will make you successful in that drill." So, like, for example, if you're just do rolling the ball in the corner, up and, from 4 to, basically 12, we would just run after the ball and chase it around and try and pick it up. And he came in like first practice. He said, "Well, here's what you really want to do. You want to cut your player off, step in front of them so that you get an uncontested ground ball and it's easy to pick up. And then when you pick it up, you turn away and get your head up and look for an open player." So it was certainly a different way of coaching than just doing drills that. My dad and his buddy were saying, "Well, you just go get the ball in the corner. Hopefully you win it."
I'll say this. I almost say it once per podcast. Like the things that lead to lasting behavioral enhancement are the power of role models, goals plus an action plan, and having standards or expectations. And the fact that you just brought up them in the first two questions that I asked you, you had these role models really early on. Both it was both your friends, but also, bringing Ron into the picture and your father to have the wherewithal. Two books that come to mind. There's a book called Bounce, the ping pong book, and how at one point the top players in the entire world all came from the same street. And that's because they had the same access to this one ping pong table that their gym teacher left open. And then the other book that came to mind is Outliers, on these like serendipitous things that happen to happen in your life that give you that kind of edge and that edge and the edge. And the fact that it falls through in 1974 and he comes out to Victoria and you're given that opportunity, it's like, that's just amazing how the stars aligned there. And I guess one of the questions I wanted to ask you was, you said, I did what the coach said to do, So you were coachable at a very young age. Is that the case? Where did you get that coachability? Because I don't feel like everybody has that. Would you agree or disagree?
Well, I think, having parents that say, if you're going to play, you have to listen to your coach and respect your coach and do what he says. That starts right there. And then, once you start seeing success, like being a sponge, when he would say how to win a ground ball or how to learn, and his technique on learning, he really taught me how to mimic and visualize how to learn something without being taught it. And that was probably the greatest gift, because that's what I spent, the first year coaching with him, trying to be like him. And I learned to do all his stick work, his fakes, his I always tell people this, it's funny that my stick work and all these trick shots and things I had been known for, I could do them all at 12. Like that was something once I got into it, I every day go to the wall in the schoolyard behind my house and start working on every single thing that I saw. And I'd always watch whether it was an adult team or someone on my team or somebody on the other team we're playing. If somebody did something that was awesome, I would go teach myself how to do it.
I said this thing in sports psychology for a long time, emulate until you can innovate. And it sounds like me that you went right to the innovation as a 12-year-old and you were just innovating because you were emulating. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. It made it fun. And we were certainly a generational group of kids that were taught by him. And that whole group went on to win every single Canadian national championship from peewee, bantam, midget, intermediate, junior, senior. And the same in field lacrosse as well. So, and many of us went on to win the, a few of us went on to win the worlds and that as well.
I want to bring this aspect up because you brought up fun, and then the creativity aspect and the play into it, right? It wasn't just compete. It sounds to me, and I'll bring him up one more time. Brody said something that you brought to him when he was a young rookie was kindness. And that's kind of like overlooked in the sport, which is an amazing kind of thing to even think about that the greats seem to have. How were you always able to manage both that like creativity, fun, play? And that intensity and competitiveness. How were you able to do both so well?
I think part of it was having a twin brother, but more importantly, it was having best friends that were identical twins. And it was recognizing the difference between us. So my other friends, the Pepper brothers, actually they got a son playing at St. Bonaventure now. They competed, and they competed every day, basically until they were fist fighting every single day. Like they just, would be chasing each other out, hitting each other. And my brother and I said, we just weren't like that. We were the opposite, where we helped each other to improve and compete. So we would compete, but we'd also share, and we'd want each other to be successful, so we would help each other. So I think that's kind of part of it. Like I never thought up thinking I needed to be, I wanted to be good, I wanted to be better, but I thought it was important for my brother to be great too. And that goes for my teammates or anybody playing. I always thought
Right.
that.
So, for those who are listening who are not in tune with the lacrosse world, Gary's brother Paul was as exceptional. I guess I would ask you right then and there, what were the similarities and differences between you two, either then or even now, if you guys were so similar and identical?
Very subtle. Really, it was. I really love the flair, the tricks, the fun out of that, and so I was focused on, the big fakes, the deceptive shots, the different, that sort of area. And as we got older, unfortunately, Paul started with an injury bug and started with a broken wrist that lasted, I think, 3 or 4 years. It was a skyphoid bone in his wrist. It was not diagnosed for the first year and a half, and he had to tape his wrist every time he did anything. And then they put a cast on for like 9 months and it didn't heal. So then he had to have a bone graft and from his hip into his wrist, and it just kind of set him back from being able to do a lot of the fun stuff. So he became more of a using his athleticism more than his stick work and stick skills, like the tricky stuff, the hand wrist control stuff. But certainly equally as good or better at everything else, scoring, competitive. He just did it a different way.
I was going to go there at some point because it must not have been easy all the way through. It wasn't this 4-year-old that picked up the stick, got lucky, had this coach, da, 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 da. Like, I wanted to ask you about some of the hardest chapters in your lacrosse career, right? And how you were able to bounce back from them. I know Paul went through the wrist now, but what about for you? What were some hard chapters along from all the way you being a 4-year-old to winning a gold medal at the Worlds? What would you point to?
You know what? I think I'm pretty blessed. I think I got to see the hardships through other people. And I was very lucky. I never had, knock on wood, I never had an injury, serious injury, ever. Never had a concussion. Everything my brother had, I would joke and say, I really appreciate you taking all the injuries for me. And it wasn't great. I had a, hamstring tweak here or there, calf pull here or there, but never had any significant injury over my however long I played, a long time.
So then a big part of this podcast is that gratitude aspect, and you brought up Ron earlier, you brought up Roy Simmons. Maybe if you want to talk about Roy at all, but are there any other influential figures in your lacrosse journey, whether they were a teammate or a coach, that were really instrumental in your growth?
Oh yeah, a guy by the name of Chris Hall, who is a Hall of Fame member. He was a Canadian national coach, but he was a coach of the Victoria Seaspray lacrosse in 1979. The Canadian national team won their first world championship in field lacrosse, and that sparked funding to start field lacrosse again across Canada. At that time, there were no field leagues. There was nowhere to learn the game of field lacrosse. It was all box lacrosse. because of that world championship, there became funding, and then there were coaches that got involved, and Chris Hall was one of those guys. And my dad got involved. He actually found the sponsor, Seaspray Properties, and they sponsored a from youth to senior field program that started in 1979. So I started playing field lacrosse at 12, started playing box. So it all came around. And amazingly enough, you know, within 2 or 3 years, Chris Hall was nice enough and saw the success we were having with our that special group of that team that with Ron McNeil, we started playing field lacrosse as well. And we were very good at that as well. You know, very organized. We traveled down to the US. We crushed everybody down there on the West Coast. And certainly you know, had some great teammates that could play as well. And Chris Hall invited my brother and I to start playing with the men's team. So it was much more like a European setup where you have a clubhouse and a organization. And that's, I have always attributed women's field in Australia's success due to the system they have where if you they recognize a young athlete that can compete at the adult level, they bring them up. And so we did. My brother and I were brought up around probably 14 years old, 14 going on 15, and we started playing men's lacrosse. Played on the team, won a couple Canadian championships as high school, and in fact, I remember competing against Rutgers University. Came out for a trip 1 year.
Wow.
Coach Tom Hayes and my brother and I were in high school. We were in like ninth grade or 10th grade or something.
Wow.
And we were on the team. And, you know, years later after being at Syracuse, I remember Tom Hayes telling me, I guess I missed that one.
Yeah, I'd
I
say.
Said, well, I don't know. I only had 3 goals against you. Like, so, I think he was pretty funny. He had the first crack, but you know, probably didn't know we were, you know, ninth graders at the time and playing on a men's team, but it was fun. And you know, that opportunity led to growth in so many ways. You know, all of a sudden competing against, you know, we had a couple 40-year-olds on the team and things like that. Cause it was, you know, it was a mix of everybody. And then that team had success, you know, had, I think, one of the longest winning streaks in Canada, the most Canadian field national championships of any program. It's a Hall of Fame team and program that we were on. And it, you know, and that led to the opportunity at Syracuse.
Got it.
It really did.
And the what it sounds like to me, no wonder the game slowed down for you at such a young age. I mean, you look at the competition you're playing against. Once you got to Syracuse and then you played professionally and then internationally, obviously your game has to evolve and you have to use different things than you were doing when you were in ninth grade. Could you talk about that evolution, about how your game had to even keep going to another level?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, just to finish that how to get to Syracuse, it was got invited at just turned 16 and we got invited to try out for the Canadian national team. So I started the national process before college. So tried out for Canada and the coach was Bobby Allen. He's a Peterborough Hall of Famer, lacrosse guy. He coached the 79 World Championship team and coached through 86 as the head coach. And Chris Hall talked him into inviting a couple, you know, high school kids out. And we tried out in Toronto. I remember the trip. And it was quite an experience, you know, playing box at the same time. I think I had like 7 stitches in my elbow when I tried out. And you know, didn't make the team, and that was probably one of the better things that happened, you know. And we're like, oh, because we thought we played pretty well, and did ever, didn't know, but didn't make the team, so no big deal. And years later, he came back and said, well, you were better than the guys I took, but you were just so young. We just thought we'd take older guys. And Bobby apologized and said, I probably should have taken you, but who would have known, right? You're so young. Are you really going to take some 10th graders to a Canada national team? But he sort of, because the next opportunity was the 90 World Championships, which we did play in. So, but Bobby was the one that called Coach Simmons and said, if nothing else, I owe you one. I got these two high school kids that tried out. And he said, I guess I don't know what he said, but whatever he said, Coach Simmons was definitely, he was bought in and he was ready to go.
Awesome.
So
Awesome.
that's
And
how we got to see.
you said it was one of the best things for you,
Oh yeah,
getting
probably.
cut.
You gotta learn to fail and get back up and get better. So if you always, that was quite a year. I ended up playing in my first man cup that summer as well. So I
Remarkable.
was just 16 playing in a man cup is pretty cool. In Peterborough, Ontario, another trip out east. So it was fun.
As your game evolved, and this would probably be the last question, as you as an athlete, how did you maintain the motivation to play for such a long time and have such an illustrious career and have the longevity that you had?
I just love to compete. There's nothing like it to put yourself out there with a group of guys and try and have success. And I guess I got, to be honest, probably addicted to winning. Loved winning, loved the feeling of success, and would work extremely hard to make sure that I did my part in my job. And I think that's why I always, people treated me very well as a young kid. And it's probably because they thought I could help them win or help them do something, I'm assuming. So I always thought that's another reason why you should treat your teammates well. Like you want them to be good, you want them to help you. So I always think that's important to, and respect them and help them and give whatever you can to help the team be successful. So that was extremely important.
It's pretty rare to have that kind of transition to coaching, where you're just as exceptional as a coach as you were a player. Could you talk about kind of what transferred well for you as a player to coach and what kind of needed to be different?
Well, that's pretty easy for me. Like, again, young, 15, my brother and I took over a team. We were asked to coach a 12-year-old team. So we were co-head coaches of the B team, not the A team, of the same organization we played for that were 3 years younger
Wow.
than us.
Oh, wow.
And we were encouraged by our coaches to do it and said, you're capable, but the whole reason that I felt good was how I was taught to learn a game. And that was to understand why you did drills, how it correlated to success on the floor. So I was being trained basically to be a coach and teach the skills of the game of lacrosse. And I think, getting a taste of it young, I loved it. We only did it one summer because we were too busy any other time because we started playing for multiple teams and other sports and everything else going on. So, but that, and I didn't realize that that was going to be something down the road, finishing at Syracuse. I never thought I was going, like, no one ever said you should become a coach. There was no pro lacrosse at the time. There was in Canada, everything was volunteers. if you're a coach, you just volunteered. It was never a job. Coach Simmons, I saw, and it was a job for him, but he had to have another job because he wasn't really getting paid to do it. So, or not paid well. So I never thought of it as a career. And but I did get into the camp business because I love to teach kids. So, started a long career of camps. When I was finished at Syracuse, started Gate Brothers Lacrosse camps and started putting on camps all around the country
Amazing.
and passing on what I learned, how to learn why you do drills, what drills correlate to in a game, when you do things, when you don't. And I just started, teaching that way. And again, never really thought of becoming a coach. And then I was working for STX Lacrosse at the time, and my coworker Aaron Millen was offered a job to coach at the University of Maryland. And she didn't want it. She was an alum from there coaching women's, played women's lacrosse, and she didn't want to take the job, but she knew I was looking to do something different than what I was doing. She said, "Why don't you look at it?" And so Cindy Timshaw called me, and I went down and met with her and said, "Sure, I'll give this a shot. I'd love to do this." She was flexible and willing to work around my pro lacrosse career and my endorsement of SDX lacrosse and all of that. And she said, "Yeah, I can make that work." And so she, was an hour commute each way, but I was in
And
and I started.
you found success there right away, and for 7 years in a row, I think I was researching. But take us inside of that.
I was there
How do you guys
9 years.
sort
The first year, again, I had seen like 10 minutes of women's lacrosse, honestly. At the North-South weekend, I saw the North-South women's game for 10, 15 minutes. And they had these wooden sticks and they were running around cradling, very unique, like windshield wipers. And I'm like, what? I was just kind of perplexed by how they could play like that. So Cindy was awesome. And she said, "Gary, help me here. Help teach these players how to be better and improve their stick work, improve everything." And I just went right back to my roots of why you do things to make so you can do them better on the field. And, I can give you a few examples that, they used wooden sticks, which the ball had to sit right at the base of the stick. They carried the stick vertical and they two-handed cradled. And so I did it and I'm like, I sure can't run very fast this way. Like, this is not the best way to play this game. Like,
Right.
there's a better way to cradle. And I taught the players how to cradle in a running motion so they could run faster. And then I taught them how to put it in one hand so they could even run faster. And then I started teaching them how to pick up ground balls better, how to, throw it harder. Like, I can honestly say, like, I remember trying to teach them how to take like a plant shot or a crank shot. And I would say that, two out of 10 knew what that was or could do it. And the rest of them, I'd say, take a crank shot or a plant shot, and they would just shoot on the run. And they wouldn't, because they just never, like, nobody taught them any of these things. And they never learned, like I learned, by watching other people. Or they did learn by watching other people, but they were stuck in a world of tradition that just taught, continued to replicate what they were taught over and over without thinking of there's got to be a better way to do this. So that's what I took to the women, was like, I'm just gonna teach them how to do things better than everybody else.
Was that the main reason that there was winning? Is because of the differentiation in stick skills and the technique and the fundamentals, or were there other reasons as well?
But then we took that to every aspect of the game.
Got it.
You know, like we got organized and, you know, we were the first team that, like at the time, there was no restraining lines. There was no boundaries there. So we were, I'm like, well, why does that person have to stand back on defense? And Cindy said, you don't. I said, well, then she's pretty good. Let's get her down here to score a goal for us. And we were the first team to play literally 12 on 12 in front of the goal.
Oh my.
And we had all formations, set plays, pieces, and we were deeper than most teams, and we were athletic. And then our skills started get catching up. And
Right.
then all of a sudden we started winning.
Wow.
And we, you know, I would certainly credit Cindy for changing the women's game from, you know, into a modern lacrosse game for sure.
There's
Because
so
then
much
they changed the
innovation.
rule trying to help other teams.
Right.
Because we were so organized, so skilled that we could, all 12 could play defense, all 12 could play offense, and other teams conceptually were having trouble with that. And I think we went on our first 50 game winning streak. And then they changed the rules to put restraining lines in and make it 7-on-7. Then we went on another 50 game winning streak after that.
Because you just adapted and improvised to meet that.
Oh, yeah, you know, you just, that's what people always ask, how did you teach the women's game? Well, I think if you're listening, you just heard it. I just taught skills, concepts based on the rules of the game.
Yeah.
And lacrosse is very unique like that because everywhere I ever played, every game had a different set of rules. And it's one of the issues with lacrosse. It's not like soccer, it's not like basketball. You know, I grew up playing international field lacrosse, which was way different than college lacrosse and two-way midfielder, you know, and then all of a sudden you're specializing when you get to college, playing different rules. It's a totally different game. And
Right.
box lacrosse, just lacrosse, totally different set of rules.
Right.
Women's lacrosse is just lacrosse, just a set of different set of rules. And that's the way I looked at it and approached it. So,
I wanted to ask you that, what are your main repeated messages? I would believe it's under the umbrella of teaching the intention of why they're doing something. But even to this day, when you're coaching the men at Syracuse, do you find yourself coming back to the same kind of messages repeatedly that you want to see out of them?
you know, at this point, you know, the kids are pretty skilled. And we certainly work on developing that. But again, it's more of an understanding of why we do this. And for the first time in my career, I haven't been the offensive coordinator. So I actually had to develop myself as well. And I think I have an incredible offensive coordinator in Pat March. And a defense warden, John Odierna, and Nick Acquaviva, goalies and faceoff. And I've transitioned to becoming a true head coach,
How's that been for you?
which has been tough. It was tough for me, I'll be honest, you know, because I want to be there. I want to be, you know. So instead, now I just work with those guys. You know, I you know, certainly as a coach in that, I understand they don't want me micromanaging them. You know, I would never have wanted that. Cindy always gave me the freedom to run the offense I wanted, and with, you know, talking to her, letting her know what we're doing. And I always thought that, you know, if I wasn't, then I got to find somebody that I feel comfortable with that I can
Right.
let do that. And I was lucky that Pat March was already at Syracuse. He was one of the best young offensive coordinators out there. Why Syracuse hired him before I got there, and a great recruiter as well. So, you know, I made that adjustment. So, you know, now I focus on giving players tips and you should
Got
try
it.
this, do that, and how about some shooting? Like, why not try more deception? You know, so I try
Yeah.
and teach them little things, and then, you know, in general, try to make them great teammates and play. Do it the right way for the right reasons.
So taking it back, to when you were first starting out as a coach to now where you're at, right? You said you've had to evolve yourself as a coach. To the young coach that's listening to Gary Gate right now, what advice would you give to that young coach that's just starting out?
Well, be inclusive. I would say that. Communicate with your, if you're just an assistant or whatever, communicate and learn from your head coaches. Absorb, be a sponge. But hopefully you can develop relationships where you can start using your skill set and your start implementing some of your beliefs, and that's through a relationship with your head coach or other assistants or whatever it is. And then don't be afraid to try anything, like analyze the game. And if you want to create a new way of doing things, do it. Try it. See how it works. Certainly what I did in the women's game forever was, create new offenses and, try different things that were never done before. And that just comes from, thinking about things. And I love the power of the brain. If you focus on things, you can get results and you can create things that have never been created before. And in the lacrosse field, I take that same idea to creating lacrosse products. And that we, my brother and I have a list of patents and ideas and things that were not done before, but there's always a way to figure out how to do it if you put enough time and energy to think about it. And then you get inspired by something that you see or hear or whatever, and you can create something new that's never been done before. And I've always thought that's the way I played with that same mentality, and that's the way I coached, and that's kind of just the way I like to think of things,
I would say when I look at the artist, the entrepreneur, the innovator, they seem to play at that edge, right? Where they kind of know the rules, but they're always trying to take it to that next level. And I think that's what you are referring to with Gate Lacrosse, how you teach the sport in general. I guess I would ask you about that. Is that an innate personality thing about yourself where you've always been a dreamer like that, innovative, or do you feel like you developed that as well?
I think that started young, much like the lacrosse side of things. Very middle class family. When we were young, I had an older brother, dad, that anytime he made anything, we never really bought a lot of things. If we did, we bought supplies to make things. So I started, I could, some funny stories, but we wanted a skateboard ramp when we were, 12 years old, so we built one. Well, this thing was a half pipe, 12 feet high. It was a monster. The neighbors hated us, but we were like, we'll make it. If we want one, we'll make it. And then, we were like, well, we want a like a electric skateboard. Well, of course, there was no such thing back then. So we grabbed the lawnmower, bolted it on the back of a skateboard that we made, and
Amazing.
we'd make our own skateboards. We'd make the boards, laminate them, do all that. And I always loved the feeling of making something and creating something. And when I was young, my father was in the construction supply business, so my jobs were typically, I started working young. And they were, from bricklayer helpers to labor construction to all of that. So I always saw the results of hard work in making something. And I always thought that was kind of cool. I still drive back home and say, I helped build that. I helped build that. And you can see what you've done. And, but along with that, you had to solve problems. And, you had to figure out how to do things. And certainly, as a kid, I loved cars and mechanics and metalwork and woodwork and loved welding and all that stuff. So, I think our claim to fame is Paul and I were, you have high school awards. Well, we won all the awards for metalwork, woodwork, and mechanics and athletics. So that was
Wow.
our skills. It was, but
Yeah.
those are the things we had passion about,
Definitely.
So it,
Gary, I will
was,
say,
we just
like
loved making
when
everything we.
you and I spoke for the first time a couple years ago, I guess you found out I was in sports psychology. You brought it up during this podcast as well that you've been doing meditation, visualization, mindfulness as a young coach. You brought up the championship caliber and standard on how you're focusing on things off the field too, and those intangibles. Where did that always come from? Would you say it came from that kind of 12-year-old that was just learning it, or is it a mixture of what we were just touching upon and staying innovative and problem solving and on the frontier?
I think it's just a combination of experiences. It's how what you're around, how you're raised. If you want that, figure it out. I remember my dad saying, and if you something's wrong with an engine, why doesn't it work? You had to figure it out, go through the process of learning, and then, well, how can I make it go faster? How can I jump higher? Like all of that, And, I learned a lot from our first skateboard ramp, which was horribly designed. It was 12 feet high. It had 3.5 feet of vertical board. Well, I spent a year trying to launch off the top of it, when in reality, I was already launching off the top of it about 3.5 feet. Because when we realized all these competitions, the ramp vertical ended r right where it started, so that you could leave the end of the ramp. Ours, you would hit that vertical, and where you would normally be in the air, you're still going up another 3.5 feet. So it was much harder to get off the top of it. It was really, but you learned. Like I look back on that, and that was such a mistake. Why didn't we just end it there? And why did we need it so big? But we didn't know, and we figured it out later. But those are how you learn from your mistakes,
Definitely. You talk about combining it all, and I think having you on here as a guest who, as Brody mentioned, as I saw, as the lacrosse world has seized, you have it all. You have that combination of tangibles and intangibles, kindness and competitiveness. Maybe you want to point to some players that you've coached or those that you've looked up to or played against. But how about your definition or how you look at greatness, the things that go into some person that seems to have it all, whether you want to bring up an individual or somebody comes to
Well,
mind.
certainly, as a guy that just retired, Brony Merrill's one of those types of guys that exudes greatness and, does things the right way, certainly, but has that incredible compete level. And I look back on a lot of the players like John Tavares, guys I played against for years, and Dave Petromala's compete level was unbelievable, and I always tell people I've never played against a player that was as competitive as he was, and I always said he's the best guy that ever covered me, and I got to go to test it because I played, until I was almost 40 years old, so I played the best of the best every year. They graduate from college, I would be like, okay, who's the next guy? And it was unique, and his ability to not make mistakes and compete at the highest level was incredible. So I certainly give him a shout out for that. Absolutely.
I think from the start to finish of our conversation here, you talked about the competition even with the Pepper twins as well. What's interesting and what's coming to mind for me is when everybody's competing at that high standard, at that high level, it is fun. Everybody's on that
Yes.
having fun and cooperating. And I think what you'll find that lack of continuity and cooperation when somebody's competing at a higher level than the rest, and then now, you know, somebody sees it as unfair. But I just love that. I didn't know so we would be talking about compete level so much, and it's really a big takeaway for me.
That's a great point because, again, that's what my father did for us. He, instead of being at two different levels on the same team, he said, I'm gonna go ask the men's coach if you guys can play with them because he believed that you got better by playing with better people. Like, if you find a group that's has a higher skill level, higher drive to be successful, and you join that group, it's only going to help you. And that was a gift he gave us by being willing to do that and not worry about our age or getting hurt or anything. So, and then those guys that we did play with were always great, and made sure nothing there was there was always an intimidation factor being kids, right? You always had the guy saying, if you do that one more time, I'm gonna kill you. I'm gonna beat the
Right.
crap out of you, whatever. But it never bothered me. I'm like, sure, go ahead. I'm just gonna score another goal, so don't worry about it.
I mean, Gary, I reflect back on it. I still remember being a really young boy, tugging on my mom's tennis skirt because Mario down the street was inviting me to play, and he was 4 or 5 years older than me, and I could be like the fifth for basketball, the last for pickup football. Like, and I just always loved that, and I would get thrown to the ground, and you have to find your way through to navigate when you're that small person. And then once you do become that bigger athlete, you still have the tangibles and intangibles you learned when you were the smallest of the bunch, like your 16-year-old self playing against the 40-year-olds in Team Canada tryout.
Absolutely.
Gary, is there anything, but as we wrap this up, question that you wish I asked, or maybe a final message that you would leave from your wealth of knowledge in the game?
Well, I think looking at my brother, I would say that it's kind of funny because of his injuries, he retired about 10 or 12 years before I did, a few years before me. But he, for those that never saw us play, he was an equal. He certainly w wasn't anything less than that. And he was one of the greatest competitors. The number of championships that he really helped win, where he was MVP caliber, was incredible. That's one thing if I had to say, did someone do it better than you? Yeah, when we were both playing, he won more championships than I did. He knew how to put a team on his back and get it done. And and some people don't realize that. They forget. And I had an incident where my jersey was retired at Syracuse University, and the athletic director said, we're just going to induct you as the first retired jersey of our lacrosse program. And I said, you know what? That's kind of weird. I said, I've been inducted in multiple Hall of Fames and everything, and we wouldn't have three banners hanging up there if I didn't have my brother Paul. And it was, he deflected and was like, well, the committee decided it should be just you. And the amount of teammates from that era that reached out and said, this is ridiculous. And it was to me. I was like, there wouldn't be a legacy without the two of us. So they're making it right this year. So that was 2 years ago. And now they inducted Mikey Powell last year, rightfully so, most decorated player ever to play at Syracuse University. And this year they're hanging Paul's jersey up, and I just want to make sure people recognize that his greatness it ended much earlier than mine, but it was incredible while he played.
I wanted to wrap it up there, but I have to double click and ask you one more question. From the Mikey Powells to your brother, you say you put the team on their back, MVP caliber. Could you just explain that or tell a story about that, just because I want the listeners to leave saying, you know, this is something you can coach or look to breed in yourself or your teams.
I think it's hard to coach. You know, it's just part of how a person is, I think. But the ability to make plays when they're needed, you know, to step up to the challenge and just through will or just, you know, some people, you know, mental toughness, I guess, you know, they believe they can get it done and they do it, you know, and or they don't think about it, they just do it. You know, sometimes, you know, I would say that was a lot of the way I did things. And I certainly didn't think about it in the game. I had incredible focus. I don't remember. I never heard, even when I coach today, I never hear the fans or like people always come up to me. Did you hear what that guy was saying or what the other coach was yelling? I'm like, no, I didn't. I'm dialed in. I'm focused. And that's the way I think as players, you need to be if you want to be truly great. You got to be able to, you know, let everything else go and just play. And, you know, guys like Mikey Powell, Paul Gate could do that. Casey, all those guys, they just had a love for playing and they believed in themselves. And when you needed a big play, it was easy.
Oh,
It was
Gary,
easy
I
for
mean,
them.
I'll wrap it up there and just say, I love learning from you, even in this hour, but from the first phone calls we had, I really appreciate you giving me a call. And it's an absolute privilege of my life to right now to be working with the Syracuse women's team.
Well, I appreciate what you're doing with them too. Thank you for that. It's
and
awesome.
Thank you so much for this conversation. And I look forward to the future of our conversations to come.
Yeah, well, I know I'll see you down the road at one of the Syracuse women's games, hopefully in the Final Four or something like that, and we'll have some fun.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Thanks, Mark.